my best results got me 18 years in crack house with 6 times in prison. Yeah, I still say today, I could be the best tattoo artist on the planet, the nicest guy with the cheapest prices, and I can't make a single person walk through that door. But I can be willing to come do my very best, to be good to folks and give a good value, and God makes them walk in by the thousands.
Right.
I mean, I never would have imagined. I prayed I'd make $600 a week and pay the bills, you know, when I opened. And now there's 6 other artists, full-time artists.
Welcome to the Most High Show, a show about recovery, spirituality, and all that. Produced, posted, and hosted by people in recovery who have strength and hope and want to share it with you. If you or someone you love is suffering, we want you to know you are not alone. This is the Most High Show.
All right, so this episode, we haven't done in a long time, and we like to call this kind of episode Most High Bros.
Okay.
The name of the show is The Most High Show.
Okay.
But when you're here and we're here, it's Most High Bros.
Most High Bros. So a Most High Bro podcast episode is a free-flowing episode.
Okay.
So rather than kind of trying to stick to some specific structure or topic, we're going to let the conversation dictate what happens.
Gotcha.
Yeah?
Yeah.
They can be fun episodes and... And sometimes it can be good, or sometimes...
Oh, sometimes it's a shit.
I'm a talker. I'll take you somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. So, my name is Christian. I am today, the host of The Most High Show. Sitting with me is David.
Hello.
And also joining us on the show today is Shane. And Shane, rather than me giving you an intro, if you want to give us kind of just who you are and what you do.
Who are you, Shane?
Still working on that one. Give you something to work on all the time. I'm Shane. I own Agape Ink Tattoo and Winder. And I was an 18-year crackhead, went to prison 6 times, ended up homeless, penniless, jobless, and decided to do it different. Well, didn't really have a choice. The way I was doing it sure didn't work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. How'd you get into a tattoo?
Prison. Prison. Lots of free time, boring. My oldest son over there had gone and gotten a crappy tattoo from somebody, so I did one on myself so I could send it and show him and say, look, wait for daddy to get home. Yeah. And it just sparked something. I mean, I did it the whole time I was in there. I sleeved my own legs from the top of my thighs all the way to my toes, because once I saw that I could do it good, I just kept rolling. And then I got out and turned it into a whole new career.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about what that process is like, learning how to tattoo? Like, what do you do in prison? How does that work? How do you do it? Like, how do you do a tattoo? Because it's not, you're not allowed to.
No.
Right? So what does that process look like?
Well, I've always drawn. And could never figure out a way to make a living and still be alive doing art. Mm-hmm. So I went into sales for years and did a million different things. But in prison, what I did was we just popped us an old schooler that had been there forever, popped a part of Walkman and showed me how to take a plastic spoon, one of the sporks from the chow hall, and heat it up and bend it and use some dental floss to tie it all together and take a Bic pen, make a post, sharpen a needle out of a diabetic finger pricker spring and go to work. You had to take Vaseline, pack it into a half of a Coke can, put it in your steel locker, light it, gather the soot that it makes, put a little water with it, and make the ink and roll. And you better do good at it.
Yeah. Well, it has
if you're
to be
doing
like,
somebody else.
Yeah. I would imagine going through that whole thing and learning how to tattoo that way. By the time you got to like a real gun.
Oh, man. Yeah.
That's like.
Yeah, it was like this foreign alien when I first picked it up. And then I was like, wow, this is natural. I mean, it's like instead of coloring that wall with a Sharpie, I got to color it with a big wide paintbrush. You know?
Right. So
I learned. I'm all completely self-taught. Nobody ever taught me how to tattoo. And so I guess I didn't get all the constraints that technical tattooing has. So I mean, I do the cover-ups, the impossible cover-ups, things that other shops say can't be done. They send them to me. I do it for plastic surgeons out here in Atlanta that send their mommy makeovers to cover up even the worst keloid mommy makeover scars. Do it for the military to get people through MEPS.
Oh, I didn't know. That's awesome, man. Yeah,
that they have improper unacceptable tattoos, or they even have cutting scars. You know, mm-hmm. I can cover those.
Yeah.
Disguise them.
Okay.
Yep.
So you've always drawn.
Always drawn.
You always had this creative energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. About you. Get, there used to be a magazine called Cartoon, C-A-R-T-O, but it was exaggerated cars drawn. Mm-hmm. Big old tires, you know, kind of like the Rat Fink type mm-hmm. thing. And I used to sit and just draw those for hours, you know.
Yeah.
And I used to just love to draw, but then life kind of took over, and he took over. He was coming, so I had to get a real job that I could make a little bit of a living with, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting to have this creative spark, to be an artist, but then also dive into sales and then exceed at sales.
Yeah.
It's rare that somebody can, those seem to be like opposite sides of the brain, kind of, right?
Yeah, I've always been an anomaly in one way or the other. Sometimes that's been my worst enemy.
Yeah.
But like I was sharing earlier, you know, I mean, I remember when I was in elementary school, when they were creating the gifted program in Georgia and putting us into that, a few of us, my left brain and right brain are pretty much balanced. 147 left hemisphere, 152 right. And that was when I was in like fourth, fifth grade. But yeah, I'm an anomaly. Things kind of work out, the logical and the artistic, the emotional and the reasoning.
Well, that's an amazing gift, because a lot of times what I see in all kinds of like businesses, mm-hmm. there's a thing that you do, right, that makes that you want to express out and you want to mm-hmm. like venture out and see if you can make a career out of it. But then there's always a business part of it. Like mm-hmm. that's one of my mm-hmm. biggest, I would say one of my biggest issues is I love to counsel, mm-hmm. right? And I love to sit down with people. I love to learn about it. Mm-hmm. I love to observe. I like to do all those things. But the business side of it is something that is like really tough for me to like take in and understand and like to try to do that alongside it, because I'm a small business guy, mm-hmm. right? I'm blessed to have partners that really help out in mm-hmm. different areas. But for me, I'm really lean to one end mm-hmm. of that skill set of mm-hmm. what it would take all around. And I think of Christian, I think about you too. I think you wear both hats mm-hmm. very well too. I mean, you're a big creative mind, but you know, you're who I come and talk to as somebody when it comes to, you know, actual business moves and
right.
how to, you know, make something profitable, knowing the difference between a non, like all that kind of stuff mm-hmm.
Comes with anxiety. It comes with overthinking. It comes with sleepless nights. It comes with thinking of every freaking angle mm-hmm. of every kind of situation.
What can go wrong? How do I prevent it from going wrong?
Yeah. There's a lot of that.
When it does go wrong.
Yeah. Like we, you know, we've been building this software, and I don't know how we got hooked up, but we got this lawyer on the team, and you know, he calls me and says, you know, his job as a lawyer is to protect us from worst case scenario situations. Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And, you know, then he just drops his bomb. And I'm like, for me, that was so nice to have somebody who was thinking along those lines of like worst case scenario. And then let's backtrack from that, because that's how my brain works. Uh-huh. I think about, okay, if we're going to go, if I'm doing anything, if we're going to film something, we're going to do something, I'm like, if everything goes to shit, how can we still accomplish it? And then when I can backward engineer from there.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I know that we can still get it done. We'll still figure out a way to get it done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the assets that come to us from being addicts is we catastrophize.
Yeah.
But we learn through some work on ourselves and letting others work in us. That we're going to make it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, it's not going to eat me.
Right.
You know,
that's huge to keep going. You're basically saying I'm going to keep going.
Regardless.
I'm going to keep doing it. I'm
but it's also going. Exhausting to be like, God, I'm going to keep going too. Yeah, you know, like,
Lord, I've had more lawyers involved in my life since I got sober and have a little something than I ever did when I was out there forging checks and stealing this and smoking crack.
Right. Yeah.
It's like everybody wants to take what they haven't worked for or something. You know, it's crazy.
Oh, yeah.
It's the world being the world.
Yeah.
Be in the world, but not of the world.
Yeah. I guess the benefit of kind of running a nonprofit and being in this sector, right? Like, I don't have to play the game by everyone's rules in the way, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's like a conscious decision. You know, I did so many years like in entertainment and mm-hmm. and doing that, that there was just, it's like, I used to, you know, I grew up in the 80s. Mm-hmm. So I saw the Back to the Future mm-hmm. Toyota Tacoma on the lift that Marty wanted to get.
Yeah, Marty McFly.
Marty McFly. Yeah. And I owned one of those once, mm-hmm. you know, then I traded it in for a Honda Pilot because we had another kid coming. And there was a shift when I started seeing like cars and I'd be like, you know, you see a car and you go like, oh, I fucking want that car. Mm-hmm. And then there was like a shift where I was like, what's required to own that car and the payment and the insurance and the this and the that. And then it was like, I realized I don't want all the things that come with getting the one thing. Mm-hmm. And so that was like the beginning of a mental shift. And this was in recovery, you know, mm-hmm. where I think I started kind of letting go of this like chasing mm-hmm. and it's continued on like as I've continued to be alive mm-hmm. that it's like I've gotten everything I want. Mm-hmm. If I've set a goal, I've done it. You know?
Yeah. Dude, you just gave me some stuff right there, man. That was awesome. Because I mean, that's one of the very core precepts of recovery. You know, we gave up everything to have one thing, and now we'll give up one thing to have everything.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and my, one of my sponsors, he's a retired attorney and winder, 36 years sober, I think, this year, dealing with life shit and not drinking and drugging over it. And he's got what I want. But he told me years ago, he said, if you want what you have, you'll always have what you want.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very profound.
Yeah, that's a big,
you know,
that's a big
unfortunately
statement.
With my, you know, you get sober minded, you get sober spirited, sometimes these little emotions will get off and I'll make a bad decision and I won't want what I have. And what I have is not healthy, you know.
Yeah,
I've been divorced several times. I've divorced them. I can't. But I live the principles in my life in every area, and I fail at every single one of them, but I keep working at them. And I don't ever want to get them perfect. I mean, there was one that did, and they put nails in his feet and hands. I don't want to go that route.
He did it for us.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. He did it for us. But it's interesting, like, when, you know, these principles, you start to see them in reality in your life, and it's like this. For me, it's like this light bulb moment mm-hmm. of like, oh, that's what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
All the time, yeah.
And for me, I felt like it took me a really long time. I feel like I really didn't start growing until after having 10 years.
Mm-hmm. I feel the same exact way.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the first 10 years are kind of like blurry to me, but things started actually coming together after that.
Yeah.
After my 10 year.
I've heard it described as a 6-year process to begin to actually fully recover.
Mm-hmm.
The first 2 years, getting your body sober. The second 2 years, getting your mind sober. The third 2 years, you're getting your spirit sober.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I've seen a lot of that, not exactly by that timeline, but that reasoning of seeing that.
Mm-hmm.
That's
kind of like the process.
I see
it, right?
Yeah. You know, I've seen it.
Yeah,
you know, to take real surrender, because we'll surrender the best we can at the beginning, and then
I did it like
a few months later. Yeah, I did it like this, this. but then we'll surrender even better after we start seeing some more truths, and we'll tell the best truth we can at the beginning, because we don't even know what the truth is.
Yeah.
I didn't even know me.
Yeah.
So it took me a long time, and the truth still changes. It's not that the truth changes; it's that my understanding of the truth changes.
Yeah.
Understanding the nature of me changes and it grows.
Yeah.
And I think that's exactly what we learn. Like you said, after the 10-year mark, and it's not about the drug and our drinking, it's about our thinking and about our spirituality, that we really, the confines come off.
I feel like it was like kind of like, you know, what I saw was I knew my life was changing. Like, you know, it was kind of like, you know, substances is always a priority, but now at 10 years, not using, everything is really about my life,
mm-hmm.
like in my purpose and moving forward and like taking those principles and the structures from what I've learned, you know, getting into sobriety. I understand like, oh, these are the things that are keeping me moving in my life. Like this is the structure that's helping me move day by day. And just the whole idea of it moving day by day is sobriety, you know, that's an instillment that I learned trying to be clean.
Mm-hmm. I think it took me 10 years to realize I actually am the problem.
Yeah.
There was 10 years of me trying to blame everything else and figure it. And then finally it took 10 years to go, oh no, this is my, I am the problem. I am the author of my own chaos, my own happiness, my own confusion. Yeah. It's all coming out. And that's a hard, you know, and like, I think like you said, like, it's like you kind of, it's like a depth of realization. Mm-hmm. And when it hits like the soul, and you go, oh shit, that's like an awakening.
It's definitely accountability. If you can look in the mirror and say, you know what? I had this happen in my life. I had this happen in my life, you know, and those things can be negative things, right?
Yeah.
But it's like when you look in the mirror and say, this is it. It's about me, man.
Yeah.
I cannot stop screwing up like this. I'm doing it over and over again. I'm using excuses. You know, I might be playing like the victim role. I might be procrastinating at these things, but ultimately it's like, this has to change me. Not all this around me. Whatever's around me is always going to be around me.
Yeah.
But for me to function, I got to like do some self work.
Yeah.
And be real about it. You know,
I mean, or it can not change and you could just be okay with the
insanity
you get, that,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it does take a lot of, weight off, I guess, when the realization, like, there's nothing, no one to blame, right? Like, I think about, we got agape tattoo, right? So I think about, you know, when Jesus talks about loving your enemies, right? And when you love your enemy, they stop becoming your enemy, which to me, I start following that train of thought and I think, well, then there are no enemies. And then when I... then I can stop being the enemy
to you,
to me.
Yeah.
And then I can, and it frees me up to see, oh, then I am responsible for the situation I'm in and I'm not the enemy of myself. I just need to like awaken to, does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
What I'm trying to, I got to just deal with it.
Right. And
because that, I think that was like such a, that shame cycle, that guilt cycle of constantly like beating myself up because I made the wrong call or I did the wrong thing, even if I wasn't getting high or
you might came up short at something and like,
yeah. Like and that's just not a great, I mean, it's a good motivator in the beginning. Right.
Right.
Like, little shame, a little guilt.
Yeah.
Keep you sober.
Yeah.
But you know, after 10 years, it's like, that's just not useful anymore. Mm-hmm. It's just keeping me stuck in bad patterns and behaviors.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I always say like, you know, when I think about motivation, right, to get something accomplished, if it is like in guilt or anger or like, I want to show you like that, I don't think it's solid ground.
It doesn't work out.
It doesn't work out too well.
You know, it's reminding me, you know, I owned a men's recovery. I was a partner in a men's recovery residency in Gainesville in Hall County for a few years. And that was with on the tattoo studio. That was with having twins on the way at 50 years old, I think. They're 7 now.
Wow.
And they go to school from my house. Me and mom, I divorced, but we get along great now. We co-parent together. Her life's changed so much.
Mm-hmm.
Me and her husband are close. We're like one big blended family.
That's
incredible.
Cool.
Lord, I just lost my train.
You had the sober living.
Yeah, you had the sober living.
Yeah, we had the sober living. Yeah. And I had some incredible partners. Now, this was me. This was 4 years into recovery, and I'd gone back out on a binge. And I was divorcing a lady that claimed she had a miscarriage, and I found out 3 months later she went and had
one abortion. Of those.
Yeah, one of those. Yeah. And so, you know, that puts some reservations. You don't ever think about that. They say work on your reservations. You know, you don't ever think about something like that hitting. But it was monumental.
Mm-hmm.
But so I manipulated probation to let me go to this halfway house rather than going back to prison. And I was there a couple months. I ended up buying a partnership in it. And I had some incredible partners, Todd Price, Raymond Little, Gina DeResta, Stuart Smith. They're all entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
Todd and Raymond just sold Perimeter Roofing a couple years ago for 8 figures. And now are doing other things. Stuart's got a pressure washing. Gina's a realtor and has been. Mother of 5. Incredible.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really blessed, you know, that whole surround yourself with success.
Yeah.
And you'll be the fifth. Yeah, that worked for me. There I go again. The results of many years of cocaine abuse.
But drain Bramage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'll get in the middle of something.
Having all those partners and getting into that, like, and while you were still in a halfway house?
Yeah, I was actually an owner and still staying there to satisfy probation.
Not only
still
the president, manipulating the system a little bit. Client.
Yeah. I used to be an addict, but I'm not anymore. Yeah, that didn't last very long, did it?
I guess just thinking about that, I mean, there had to be. You know, like, I feel like you're always seeing something that you can make something.
See, right.
You know what I mean?
It drove me to keep striving, but I was also very realistic. We had a guy that had left. We cured him for a few weeks, so he got his first check. And then, of course, he didn't show up for the house meeting, and he wouldn't answer anyone. And I was messaging with him. He finally started answering me. He got his check, and he was staying with this lady, and he was abandoning his wife and three kids, and he was only like 30-something, good-looking guy and intelligent. And I told him, I said, well, this is the way it's going to go. He was a heroin addict. And I said, you're going to go get you a little bit. You've got some money, a place to stay, and a girl. And it's going one of two ways. You're going to OD, and they're going to take everything you got, or you're going to OD, and you're going to die. And Lee called us the next day. He OD'd and died. He did him a little bit. But every one of those has come together to motivate me. It's always something. Like, you know, you see you'll get stagnant after 10 years. You get to seek something bigger. I see things in life all the time that are motivating me to work on me more, whether I want to or not, or whether I see something going on. I mean, I'm working on boundaries right now. That's one of the things as an addict. I didn't have no boundaries. Right. You just come run rock shot through my life.
Yeah.
You know, because I've got it's worth the suffering. Jesus suffered. You know? But it's like I walk up and say, hey, take that toe and smash my, I mean, take that rock and smash my pinky toe. It's like I was going through life. Let me suffer a little more.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, even Alex's time in active use, it's been a tool in my recovery.
Yeah.
You know, how can I lead him somewhere I don't know how to get? You know, I still follow my sponsor. He's got 35 years of dealing with life shit, not drinking and drugging over it. I've got 11. I want what he's got. So I still follow him. Luckily, he'll always have a little more than me.
Yeah.
So I keep following. But
was that a natural transition for you to like stop using and then really focus on, you know, being successful and using, you know, whatever you're gifted with to like make it in the world? Like,
it was an addict being an addict, dude.
Yeah.
I'm a firm believer that, okay, I used alcohol or drugs to feel or think different because I didn't like the truth about me. Well, in those rooms, I started figuring out I could do some work and change the truth about me to one I was okay with. So that's what I started doing. Lord, you're catching me in these gamma glitches. Right? I'm just forgetting right in the middle. Yeah. There's much stuff that goes through my mind. Yeah. It's been such a journey.
Yeah.
You know, I have the luxury of having a really hard, low rock bottom.
Yeah.
I got out of prison December 22nd of 2011 for the sixth time, jobless, penniless. Didn't have, my head clothes have been stuck in a basement for 4 years and no driver's license. You know, I managed a mortgage lender, was a corporate finance director of chain of car lots when I was strung out cracky. And I
how do you get there though? I mean, what is that? Like, how do you?
I kept getting high. That's how I got there.
Yeah. So, I mean, it just kept you going. I guess it was something that gave you, like, whenever you were using, you were smoking rock, you're still like, making ends meet. You're still like making deals.
The only ends that I had to make meet was get a hit.
Yeah.
That was the only thing that mattered.
Yeah,
was it. You know, I gave up everything for one thing, just like we were talking about.
Yeah.
But I'm a firm believer that we don't completely lose that addictive thinking. We rechannel the energy. And I tell people all the time, you know, it's a neurological fact. Our actions don't follow our thinking. Our thinking follows our actions. So if you're in there and you're in a bad mood, you're in a negative mood, or you're wanting to get higher, wanting to just argue with somebody, go clean the toilet, go cut the grass, go pick up some trash, do anything positive, and your thinking will be redirected there. Your energy will be redirected there.
Yeah.
So I took obsessing over drugs and alcohol to obsessing over not being a failure. Because, I mean, I went to a little tattoo shop, never had professionally tattooed. And 2 weeks later, I was professionally tattooing. And then 6 months later, the owner had the pill dealer in the lobby dropping him off floor tabs to crush and snort. And I said, well, I can't stay sober here. So I took everything I had and opened a little shop, Agape Ink Tattoo and Winder, so I could control my environment and I could hopefully stay sober.
Yeah.
You know, I took a leap of faith, and a lot of it's been about leaps of faith.
I just see it as such power moves to me, though, like to be able to, you know.
It was powerless. I was scared to death about it. Ended up almost in a crack house.
But you still did it, though.
I mean, I still did it. Yeah, you still did it. I was also scared to walk down there through the hood when they had like three cops sitting over there. But I wanted to go get that hit, so I was going to go through the woods somewhere. You know? Any links. And I had to go to any links. But I was firmly convinced. I had an old lawyer come see me. Oh, God, it's been 29 years ago now. But it was 15 years before I got sober. Mm-hmm. And he ended up being one of my sponsors, Sean. He came to see me. He didn't want to talk about my charges or anything like that. He came to talk to me about coming to the Jug Tavern, our local AA meeting room, mm-hmm. getting sober and changing my life. And I didn't want to hear that shit. I don't want to get high.
Right.
Yeah. So that's what I did for another 15 years. Went to prison 3 or 4 more times. I mean, I couldn't stay out 6 months.
Yeah.
But finally, when I got out this last time and I relapsed, and I'm sleeping on mama's couch, I heard his voice in my head for the first time in 15 years. And wow. Go to the Jug Tavern, get sober, and change your life. And I walked over there. It's about 1.5 miles from my mom's house. And there he sat. And we've been doing this for
He was there. That's wild, man.
And he's still daily
I've been waiting
maker.
Here the whole time.
Yeah, he's still there. Wow. And what's really cool is you see it. I've seen it come full circle. Now, there's other ways people get and stay sober. I really enjoy mine. Mm-hmm. I enjoy the fellowship. And Lord being having somebody to lead me and me lead others. But, like, he taught me a lot of stuff. And shared a lot of stuff, his experience. Didn't give me his opinion because experience is fact. He's already done it for me. But he had a daughter that would get drunk, lose everything, go to jail, and then she'd get sober for a little bit, and she'd get a six-figure income, and then she'd go get drunk, she'd get sober, you know, and all that. And he suffered over it. He suffered over it, suffered over it for years. And finally, we were sitting at a meeting one day, and I got to give him back exactly what he gave me.
Mm.
And he was giving it to me over Alex,
uh-huh.
you know, because Alex was still going out there in his active addiction. And yes, I told him, I said, well, poor little Lacey, she's having to come back and stay in daddy's mansion and eat daddy's mm-hmm. steak, and daddy's mm-hmm. having to buy her new car. There's consequences for her actions, just so horrible, you know. And he just looked at me like, you son of a-. But he was hearing what he had given me.
Sure.
And that taught me a lot. You know, we get to, if we hang around long enough, we'll have something valuable to give back. Wow. And it might take a year, it might take a decade, but we'll have something to contribute. Because when I come in, I didn't have nothing to contribute. I never went to a meeting to stay sober. I didn't want to stay sober. I want to stay out of crack. I wanted to stay out of chain gang and not be homeless.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't want to stay sober. I gave up on staying sober. That just wasn't possible.
Same thing with mm-hmm. me. I just knew, like, I was, like, in my sober mind, because I was in prison, mm-hmm. I'm like, all right, this, I'm never going to stop getting high.
Mm-mm.
I just got to figure out how to stop coming in here and spending all this freaking time in here.
Right.
You know what I mean? And that was kind of like the beginning process. But, you know, it's a blessing to me now. But that length of time of thinking like that was under those confinements. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And after a while, you know, I would just do the same things I did every time I went to jail. I'd go to church. I'd go to church. I'd go to AA and I'd go to NA.
Mm-hmm.
And then it really just started sinking in, and things went to a different level as far as what I was like, how I was comprehending it. Mm-hmm. And that's how I finally like developed some hope that I could actually not do this anymore and I could actually change my life. But my train of thought at the beginning was, all right, I've already showed I keep failing at every attempt of stopping. I can't stop. So I'm just going to do dope.
Try to maintain.
And I'm gonna try, but I just don't want to keep coming here, man.
Yeah. Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That was a big thing for me.
Yeah.
That was a big change. That understanding changing while I was in there.
Yeah. See, I didn't do that. I would start saving like the last couple months I was in there, everything, every penny I could on my book, so that when mom picked me up from prison, then she could take me by the PO and I could go ahead and get a clean drug screen and then get dropped off at the dope man and I was off.
I've done that many times.
That way I got a 30-day head start.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was me.
That was me too.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of times that was me.
If I knew I was doing it, you know, if I knew I was doing a bid and I was getting out and things were, you know, I was still had the connections that I had, I would like save up money or I'd ask, hey, you know, mom, before I get out, would you mind sending me a little money so I can be ready to get out and get some, get this and that? And my guys, I'd walk out of the jail and go straight to Philadelphia or straight to Baltimore to just no second thoughts.
Yeah,
to just go use, and that's after like these county bids, a time where I was clean while I was in there, but I wasn't, it wasn't like by my choice, you know what I mean?
I mean, that's what's interesting, right? It's like there's people like, that's what it means. Like we have a spiritual condition.
Yeah.
Some people you can just remove the environment and the substances. And these are the people who just, their life gets fucking better.
Yeah.
All of a sudden they're like, oh God, my life's great after I got sober. And, but then there's some of us that just have the spiritual condition where it's like, you can remove all the influences, all the environment, all the substances, and we are still going to want to. So as soon as we have access to it again, that's the insanity of it. I think that's like what, like in the literature, when it talks about, we have this spiritual condition, that there's something different about, there's some people who use or abuse drugs and alcohol, right?
Yeah.
And that's just the consequences of drinking all the time and using drugs all the time. You get chemically dependent.
Right.
That's one thing. That's not what I got.
No, me neither.
I got a problem. I got a problem where it's like, I don't need drugs and alcohol to ruin everything. I can do it just being selfish and self-centered and, you know, egotistical. And also, you know, poor me and all this kind of stuff. I don't even need to get high to ruin things. And I think that's like the, that's what in the literature where it talks about this like spiritual condition that we have, the spiritual malady.
Yeah.
That's the malady where it's like you're in, you're clean. You have this 4 months, 6 months, a year time where it's like, okay, you haven't, no substances entered your body.
Right.
So by, you know, by all means, you're kind of like cured of the obsession, right?
The physical whatever physical dependence,
the physical dependence is not there
anymore.
But then you get out, and the first thing you do,
is
go to get high, because this is spiritual.
This it's all is, in your mind and this soul, is man.
Mind and soul. Yeah. That's what. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
what Roland. It's what Carl Jung was talking about with Roland Hazard in the big book. You know, it's and Dr. Silkworth, you know, it is a spiritual malady. It's something that's beyond the normal realms of psychology, psychiatry, or medicine. It's a big hole that we pour stuff in to make us feel or think different.
Yeah.
And what I was talking about earlier about redirecting the energy was, I learned that I could redirect my energy into something positive. For me, my sponsor, it's the one thing that he ever told me don't do that I did that turned out okay. But boy, it's been rough at the beginning for years. And that was open a business, you know. But I was at the point that I could not fail. I had
Chase was do or die situation, 13, right?
Yeah. I took every penny. I was it. I had to be there open to close 7 days a week to get it off the ground. So I always had somewhere I had to be. So I was never somewhere I shouldn't be.
Yeah.
You know, but it's very rare that it works that way. With my partners at the rehab, it's worked that way. They always had somewhere they had to be, so they weren't somewhere they shouldn't be. But I mean, 99% of the time, he was exactly right.
Well, yeah, because the pressure of there's a buddy I know that just went through that, right? Mm-hmm. Went full entrepreneur, you know, put a bunch of money in the business. 6 months later, you know, he's looking for a chemical solution to deal with all the stress, right?
Yeah. Wow.
But I can see a, such a change, man. I can, especially with the suffering over things, where the 12 steps have, and the principles and of my faith have invaded my spirit deeper and deeper and taking over. Like I go to the Bethlehem
without
Church.
You even asking, it just happens. Yeah. And you're kind of like, oh shit, now I can't enjoy this.
For that 27 years ago, and here we go. You know, God remember. I go to Bethlehem Church, which is, they just moved our main campus like a quarter mile from my tattoo shop. It's amazing. Wow. It's this big church and this big community in Winder. And we're teaching on less of me, more of the Holy Spirit. Pastor Jason is now, and he's incredible. He's great. Very practical sermons and fun. But that's what it had to be. It had to be less me, more him. But I don't suffer. My sponsor told me right at the beginning, pain is mandatory, suffering's optional. Mm. We're fortunate. I see far more drunk junkies out in everyday life that never had a drink or a drug than I do people that are recovering. Mm. Because they got those same behaviors and same habits. It's not about the drugging or the drinking. That's just a symptom. That's just what we poured on it.
Yeah.
But God's given me things like I filed for an annulment recently, going through a rough thing. I bought into a business, and now he's committed federal fraud, and he's in a lot of trouble, and lawyers are handling that for me, and I don't have to. But you give it to me 3 years ago, I would have been the end of the world. I'd be catastrophizing. I'd be telling everybody about it. Poor me.
Yeah.
And now it's like I said, well, thank you, God. When I owned that same rehab, I used to go to Free Chapel a lot. And I love Jensen Franklin. He's cool. He is really down there, a pastor, even though it's a mega church. Yeah. But he taught a sermon, and it gave me one of the two questions I think that have defined my life ever since. God is everything or God is nothing.
Mm.
But any kind of trouble or tribulations I'm going through is exactly what's supposed to be happening.
Mm-hmm.
It is me. If nothing else, it's God increasing my faith. Because you don't go to the gym and work out with 5-pound dumbbells and get stronger. You go 5, 10, 25,
mm-hmm.
you know, so you carry harder weights to increase your faith. So it's God is everything or God is nothing.
Yeah.
Or either I'm going to make excuses or I'm going to make a way. That's the two things that have defined my life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that I follow that too. But the thing is, I think it's kind of like what you were saying, Christian. It's kind of like I look back and things that used to get to me or things that I thought would be difficult, like just life on life stuff, right? And I'm like, damn, I'm cruising past this.
Yeah.
I'm dealing with it.
And
once I get that confidence, it's like, here. Deal with that.
Yeah, it's like that pink cloud in recovery they talk about is cockiness.
Yeah.
And after the 10 years, it changes to confidence, because confidence is based on experience and achievement and progress.
Yeah.
So it becomes confidence. And we can rest that not on our laurels, but on that we have some simple things that we can do in our life. For me, it's the steps and make a meeting and help another addict.
Yeah.
And that we don't have to just sit there and wallow in whatever's going on. We're too damn busy doing good stuff to wallow in the bad.
But it is kind of like, you know, I get to a point where I'm like, okay, this is good.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
And then something else happens and I go, I really don't want to continue growing. I'm kind of happy in this little sandbox here. I don't really want to keep moving forward. And like, you know, you mentioned sponsor, and that's what my sponsor, you know, he's like a kid who stays in the sandbox, shits in the sandbox.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, God. I'm like, I'm going to stop buying you breakfast. I know. If this is what I'm going to get every Friday, you know, because.
But
just that simple phrase, right? The kid who stays in the sandbox, shits in the sandbox. It's like, it makes me girdle my loins, swallow my pride, and go, damn it. Okay, you're right. I got to keep moving forward, you know, and it's tough. It's hard for really anybody really to like to continue to kind of finally get a space of like peace, ease and comfort and a sense of like everything's not burning down.
Yeah,
that's right.
For the first time.
Yeah.
And it's like, and then to feel that release and that relief, but then here comes another challenge. We have to
There's always another set of circumstances.
Yeah.
Because in some ways, sometimes it's like maintaining that brings new things. Or sometimes, you know, it's just like if you have this, it's almost like then there's this. That's next. Like the next chapter is coming. And the next chapter comes with a whole other set of circumstances that you got to try to figure out.
But I like what you said about the confidence thing, because I think like it is not a confidence in self, but there's a confidence that, you know, what we say, like it'll work out or it'll work
out. Yeah, it'll be okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Like it'll be fine.
My confidence is more like, you know, I've got a program I can lean on. I've got simple steps I can work. I've got somebody that can help lead me with more experience than I have. But also it's just, it's a choice today whether I'm going to suffer in it or not. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Even after years in the program. So, about the 10-year mark, you really get a lot more into the spiritual part of it. And that's when it really invades the very fiber of who you are. It's the rote method. This is just doing the same thing over and over again. Mm-hmm. And it'll change. It's the best method of learning in history is the rote mm-hmm. method. I use a lot of analogies in my recovery. Mm-hmm. Well, I've got one. When I first opened my shop, I go sit in my chair, and I'd have to search for ink caps and search for this needle and search for that color and search for this machine and search for my paper towels. Now I can go in. I've been doing it so long over and over again the same way that I can close my eyes and go in and set up for a tattoo. Mm-hmm. It changed the nature of the way I did it. Yeah. And that's what the 12 step, that's what recovery has been to me. It's changed the nature of the way that I handle and do things so long that it's changed the very nature of who
What's
I am
this
as
rope?
A human being.
What's the rope thing? What's
rote, R-O-T-E.
Oh, routine.
It's doing the same thing. It's just like in school where they have you write the same sentence over and over and over and
okay,
over.
It's
doing the same thing over and over again.
Oh, my God.
It's the best method of learning in history.
Yeah, but it's like for an addict, it's the fucking worst thing. How fucking boring is that? You know what I mean?
Yeah, but how long have we done it? We wake up in the morning, I got to get a hit. Yeah. So it changed the nature of who we are. Every morning, the first thing we had to do was get high.
We
run through life trying to change a flat tire with a screwdriver and a hammer.
And you don't have to like it for it to work, right?
No. Most times it's going to be uncomfortable.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be. Everything can't be enjoyable.
Yeah.
To get what you want, it comes with a lot of, you know,
and
suffering.
That's where the God is everything or God is nothing.
Amen.
And I'm going to make excuses or I'm going to make a way is what how that – that's a lot of ways that I face that. And the serenity prayer. You know, God, grant me a serenity. Accept things I cannot change, courage, things you can, and wisdom to know the difference. That third one sometimes is the toughest.
But
that's when I usually reach out to somebody else. Hey, we're trying here.
Right, yeah.
I'm under trying, you know.
Well, I mean, like those prayers are like tools now
for big me, time.
You know,
we were just talking about
it's that, not a sense of like, okay, is this going to get answered? Is this going to not? It's this tool for when I'm in this moment of like, holy shit. Mm-hmm. I can use that prayer, and there's some other ones too that I can use that will it's just enough to get me out of this self and to do the next right thing, right? Take an action. Like, you know, it's a do program,
right?
It's do these things, not a don't program.
Right.
It's a do. And I also like what you said about taking like, cause there is like this, there's this modality where you change your thinking, right? And your behavior follows, right? Mm-hmm. Which it makes some logical sense.
Just
right?
to fake it until you make it kind of thing.
Yeah. But for me, I haven't found that to be true.
Really?
You know? It's what you said about I have to take the actions and then my thinking will follow, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can't – it's right actions over time create right thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like – and maybe it's not always that way. Maybe then after a while, you can start to see the pattern before it develops.
Right.
And then you can make a mental mind. Because I do think there's a power in like limiting, knowing what your limiting beliefs are, deleting your limiting beliefs, like all that kind of stuff. But I think that when it comes down to it, it's like this, the action is, especially for someone early, it's hard to just take the action because you don't want to. It don't feel right. Yeah. It don't feel good. But that's always been... You know, just getting down to the basics where it's like, if I'm, and this is why like I tell like some of the interns, like if it's not flowing and we're working on something and the creativity's not there, well, you just go do something else. Go clean the bathroom, go vacuum, go take a walk. But the response is action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not sitting
it's not
there
a thought.
Thinking through this
it's
shit.
It's not like, let me figure it out. I don't like this. Let me figure it out.
You can't do a fourth fist step in your head.
You know? Right. You got to go do something and then the clarity kind of will follow. Right. And that's the same thing with like the prayer. Like the prayer is an action.
Mm-hmm.
It's me taking action. By saying these words, I'm taking an action. And that's what faith is action. Right? Mm-hmm. Faith is not,
big
you
time.
Don't just like think your way. Faith
it's
is
not
like
a philosophy.
Do something.
Yeah, it's an action move.
That's what Agape Inc.'s about. I mean, I opened it because I wanted to stay sober. And that was going to take something a lot bigger than me because judges, prison wardens, probation officers, mama, everybody had tried to keep Shane sober. None of it worked. I had to turn it over to God. But God, agape is Greek for basically God's perfect love.
There's
four different terms he uses for different types of love.
Yeah.
And so it took God 12 steps to for me to live, much less
grow. How much of it is like you having something that's greater than you that you're responsible for play such a key role in.
That's that right there.
Yeah,
I got three more of them.
Oh, the kids. Yeah, kids. Right. Yeah.
You know, I didn't get sober for them though. It's a selfish program. I got sober because I wanted to be a dad.
Yeah.
Not because they needed a dad. Them having a dad is a good, beautiful byproduct of me wanting to be a dad.
Yeah, but yeah. Having, like, I think he was referring to, like, understanding, coming to the understanding that there is something higher than you. Like, there's a greater thing, you know, your higher power is, for me, I mean, it's something that, like, I'm always kind of, like, dependent on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like, I know if I follow that way, whatever my relationship is with my higher power, if I feel like I'm doing that regardless of what situation I'm in, I feel like I'm in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Because I know I'm an expert at making things. I'm like the king of making things worse. You know what I mean? I know how to make it. I know how to make a bad thing really bad.
I hear that voice all the time. It's like, just shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Say nothing.
That's one of the greatest tools I learned in recovery. Beyond the 12 steps is the ability to sit down, shut up, and do nothing. Because I at least won't make it worse. At least I won't make it worse.
For real. Because I can do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I can
mess with it. But that's where, like, the people, like, and you've been, you keep referencing, like, the sponsorship, the fellowship, the people, because like when you have that relationship with someone, especially like for men, another man, where you can call and just let all the crazy out.
I just did it before we started this podcast.
Yes.
I was like, I'm sorry, man, but listen.
Yeah, I kept telling you to stop apologizing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that's the point is, like, you know, because sometimes taking our problems to where the problem is doesn't really work, you know, and to have that, we have blind spots and we need other men to go, oh no, you're being an asshole right now.
Yeah.
Like you need to check yourself here in this. You're the one that's in the wrong.
Yeah.
And when you hear that from someone who you've built trust with, who you have relational equity with, who has a permission to tell you that, that means a lot, right?
A huge. It's like, I know if I'm, you know, fellowshipping with you, I guess you would call it, but if I know if I'm giving you something, like you're not going to, you're going to think it out. Like you're going to, whatever comes out of your mouth is going to be like what you think would be in my best interest.
Yeah.
Or it might be something that I'm like not seeing.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and a lot of times if I'm saying stuff, because I have these repetitive negative character defects in me that, you know, people won't tell me about. You know what I mean? And if nobody's telling me about it, I can block that out, right? But Christian was like, dude, y'all, you know, did you step off of that yet? You know, but I need that in my life. Well,
David is a conflict avoidant.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Big time.
Have you done any Enneagram work? You do Enneagram? Have you done the Enneagram?
Enneagram.
Uh-huh. No.
Yeah.
Okay, obviously not.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there's a type 9, which is their primary desire, I guess, or, you know, is peace.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is what, you know, I can talk about you.
Right? Yeah, of course.
So David, being his primary thing, being like he wants peace, and he desires peace. He gives peace.
Yeah.
He will bring peace into any situation. But the other side of that coin is conflict avoidant.
Mm-hmm.
So things can be going on in David's life for far too long because he's wanting to keep peace, wanting to avoid the conflict, and so it'll continue on until he finally goes, okay, fine, I have to kind of address it.
That's my patterns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, my pattern is, you know, what you said is I run a little hot.
Yeah.
So my thing is I might address it a little too, sometimes I need this shit play out.
Yeah, I'll be the same way.
Yeah.
I'm a little abrupt, a little harsh.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah.
Blacker is white. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But knowing about that about yourself, because there's also—
Or somebody else knowing that about you.
Yes.
Right. Is like meaningful to each other. Like, I know you like that. So,
yeah,
you know, maybe I can be helpful whenever it's
usually it's someone's gift is also their curse. Right.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the core of everything is helping another at it or being there. Sometimes just being there to hear it and let them get it out, take some of the power away from it.
Yeah.
But before there was a meeting, before there was a big book or there was 12 steps, there was Bill W. stuck in, what was it, Cincinnati, Chicago, somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no Oxford group meetings. And the only thing he needed to do was to not end up in a bar was to help another drunk. And he searched all over the world and found Dr. Bob in a, you know, in a sanitarium, and went and helped another alcoholic. And that's the core of it, because there was no steps.
Being
there
helpful.
There was no books. There was no meetings. But it was one addict, whatever your favorite is, helping another. And and it's service. And I mean, that's what Jesus did. He was just.
Isn't that interesting? There. Like, there's the secret. You know, a couple drunks just helping each other. And so much, so many people are looking for peace and love and acceptance and compassion, but miss that one thing, which is just going and helping somebody else.
And sometimes it's too basic for them to even.
It's too basic.
I mean, that's the 12 steps. It's the beatitude of Christ. It's just learning. I grew up going to church with my grandparents, and it was more about who drove the nicest car and what kind of clothes they wore and all this kind of stuff. It was religiosity. And so I knew about God when I started going to meetings, but he didn't have no kind of willful authority in my life.
Right.
It's where I learned to have a relationship with him. Okay, let me handle the willingness and you handle the results. My best results got me 18 years in crack houses, six times in prison. Yeah, I still say today, I could be the best tattoo artist on the planet, the nicest guy with the cheapest prices, and I can't make a single person walk through that door. But I can be willing to come do my very best to be good to folks and give a good value, and God makes them walk in by the thousands.
Right.
I mean, I never would have imagined. I prayed I'd make $600 a week and pay the bills, you know, when I opened. And now there's six other artists, full-time artists, all taking home six figures. And two piercers are taking home close to that. And then me. And
keep working on your tattoo gun.
I know. Yeah, I mean, it's, I never imagined it. It's a little tattoo shop in Winder, Georgia, and we do $750,000 a year in business.
Wow.
And, I mean, I had people fly in, and I stay grateful. That's the thing, is I got, you got to stay humble and stay grateful. Because I had somebody fly in from Austria a couple of months ago, because they had read my story, and I think Voyage ATL, and it wasn't just because I was the greatest tattoo artist, but they'd heard my story, my recovery story, my faith story, and I can do pretty good tattoos. And they flew all the way over here to get tattooed by me. Okay, am I going to be prideful of that, or am I going to be grateful and humbled by that? And that's where the program and the fellowship and even the failures have kept me, have changed the nature of who I am, to be just, man, that's amazing.
Yeah.
To step back and that's awesome. Yeah. Not look at me, you know.
Yeah.
I don't care about feeding my ego. I'm gonna feed my children.
Right.
You know, yeah, I want to get on their lives and something for them now.
Well, I mean, that's honestly why I stopped going to tattoo shops, was because there's this kind of, in most shops, and I think that's probably what the culture of your shop is, not this way, but in most shops there's this air of like the cool kids.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and I want if you're going to mark my body, this is a sacred experience. I want to vibe with you.
Yeah.
You know, and if I walk in and you're this, like, sure, you can do the best art. Right. But if you're arrogant and you're all the things I don't like about myself.
And you and he's carving your body.
No.
That was so big when I met Shane. I walked in and I swear the piece was very fast.
Yeah.
But we fellowshipped, I think maybe 2+ hours.
Yeah.
Just rapping.
Right.
Right.
Just kicking it.
We just kicked it.
Yeah.
And it was really special. I mean, it was like, damn, dude, like I can't wait
for this guy
to, you know, do his work on me. You know what I mean?
Because I got my first tattoo in California, 18. I was dating this 40-year-old. She took me to get a tattoo by the guy who did all the tattoos for American Me. His name was Cartoon. So he did the first.
Mr. Cartoon?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Real famous.
So, and then Santa Barbara. Uh-huh. And so he did the first clown. And then I got another one by her. And then I got paid. And I was living in Santa Barbara because I got kicked out of the house in Bakersfield because I was selling and using meth. And so I got paid and I was really craving meth. I mean, really. And I had like $400 or something. And instead, I went down to the tattoo shop. And I gave him all the money I had. And he did this.
Did you do that because you didn't like that you wanted? Because
I didn't want, I had the money and I didn't want to get high.
Okay, all right.
And so I went to this tattoo shop, the same shop. And I got note. N-O-T-E, because that was my tagging name,
mm-hmm.
Note across my back, but it's no one can read it. It's Chinese letters. So it's the Chinese N and the Chinese O and the Chinese T and the Chinese E written out in English. So no one knows how to read it. Not a Chinese person, not an English. No one knows how to read it. But what that That's did what it was this, it was this transference of like, it gave me the thing I was looking for. I was looking for this experience and this feeling, and it gave me all that. So as soon as I hear the gun vibrating, and then as soon as the ink pierces the skin,
Pavlov's dog. Yes. You started salivating. Yeah,
yeah.
You changed and your salivating number.
So
yeah.
That became, for me, tattoos became about that.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't about the art, which you could see on the hodgepodge of all my tattoos. It wasn't about I want to design this whole thing. It was about I want this experience again. Mm-hmm. I want this ritual. Mm-hmm. And so
that's ink therapy, right?
That was ink therapy. And so I would go to the tattooist and I would go, oh, I got some space here. I don't really know what to get, you know, and then they would go, well, how about this? Or then I would draw something and then I would get the tattoo. And that's kind of how I got all the tattoos. It wasn't like this.
That's cool. I like that. You never told me.
Which is exactly what I was talking about redirecting the energy.
Yeah.
Because you went from chasing the first high of myth to chasing the first high of that needle and that feeling. Yeah. We redirect stuff because we are obsessive personalities over anything.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how we ended up. I ended up as a junkie.
Yeah.
And so I just changed the direction over it into something positive. You know, but energy doesn't. Matter doesn't just go away, it changes forms.
Yeah.
So
I just had to redirect my stuff into something positive.
I'm sure you
learn to not be so compulsive and obsessive over things.
Yeah.
Mm. You can be obsessed but not obsessive. Yeah.
Keep it
on a healthy level.
Yeah. So I'm sure you get like clients who come in that are they're just wanting the best tattoo they can get. Mm-hmm. They want to pay the right price. They want a positive experience.
Mm-hmm. How'd you know?
But then you have those clients who are coming in, like how David came in, right? Where it's like, he wants a good tattoo, he wants a good experience, but there's also a connection, right? So for you sitting in that chair, and you're probably getting all walks of life showing up.
Yeah. Everything from attorneys to doctors to the homeless guy that limps back and forth.
How much about that do you love?
Every bit of it.
Yeah.
Every bit of it. Getting to be a part of their story. I've got to do some really incredible stuff, man. I've got to, I can do photo quality portraits on the skin.
Yeah.
And, well, God does them through me. I'll put it like that. I have to pray about it before I do them to guide me, you know, and him take care of it and just let me be a vessel. But yeah, I've gotten to use a guy's grandfather's ashes in his gray wash of doing his grandfather's portrait on him.
That's wild, bro.
Yeah. I've gotten to, women that have had major reconstructive breast surgery and had to have them removed, and they were in remission, and they thought they would never care because they were 65 or 70 about having dimples, and then they felt some way because they didn't have them.
Right.
And I was able to give them back that confidence.
Man, what a gift, dude. I mean, that is like
it
special.
It is humbling to be a vessel.
Yeah.
Of something positive into somebody else's life, because I had absolutely nothing positive to offer anybody's life for so many years.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I instill in my people. You will not come in my shop and then act like you're doing you a favor to speak to you.
Right.
You know, because I won't do that.
Yeah.
You know, when I didn't have anything when I opened, it took literally every penny I had to get those doors open. And I was grateful for everybody that walked in that door.
Oh,
and I tell them all the time, I mean, at that point, if I hadn't had my rent to pay my shop rent that month, I couldn't have called my mom and said, hey, I need $1,500 to pay the shop rent. She'd been, well, that's just too bad. Yeah. It mattered that I lost everything instantly.
Right.
You know? But then folks that walked in that door paid it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I tell my people, you know, the same thing. You might call, you have an $800 power bill. You call your mom, your brother, whatever. Oh, poor thing. Ours is life's rough here too. But then people that's walking in that door is putting food in your children's belly. They're feeding your kids. They're keeping a roof over their head. That's your family. Treat them like it. Be grateful for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, those are people that are choosing to show you a form of love, coming to you and entrusting you with this, you know, that others won't.
Yeah.
Or can't, you know, but, right. but they are. So value them. And relationship is priceless. The money's valuable, but the relationships are priceless. You know, money, you'll get paid off of this, like having a tattoo at the beach. Right. You know, they're going to do one on you. They're going to charge you out the butt, and they ain't never going to see you again. So they don't really care. Right. But build the relationship, because they'll keep coming back. Keep coming back. Yeah, you exactly. know? And it's amazing. I mean, I
think there's something very sacred about somebody doing your tattoo. And you vibe with them.
Yeah.
It's like, it's why we're here together. That's yeah, why I made sure. Yeah. Like, I was like, because it was such a connection. Uh-huh. And like, what you did for me is something that, like, I love it. It's going to be on me forever. You know what I mean? It's like that. I value that whole, it's very special to me how that all came about.
And I want to learn something about you. That's one of the things. There's no point in pick on my walls. Because 90% of the people that do this for a living are tattooists. They can take Beast 27, the heart with the dagger that's kind of crooked on the end, and they can put it on you and it'll look good. But very few in this career and in this field are actual artists. So I don't have a single bit of the point and pick on my walls.
Yeah.
You know, everybody there's got to be able to create and draw. And like really you cool. come in, you had your idea, but there's so many people that don't come in and they're they pour their hearts out. Okay, well, I'm doing a memorial for my grandfather. Well, tell me some stuff that you remember about being with him. Is there any little thing you used to hang on the wall or, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I've got one lady that she'd been everywhere and she was trying to do a set of old coveralls hanging on a barbed wire fence. And everybody's like, you just can't do it. You just can't do it. She come in. I was like, yeah, let's run it. Yeah. And it does. It looks like a whole set of the Dickey, you know, whatever it was, old coveralls hanging on a thing. And I ended up doing the whole rest of her sleeve, but we just shared about those experiences. And we even got to put something even more special in there. One side of it, her dad, he was in a, had a picture of him in a foxhole when he was in the war. Oh, that's a very hard effect to create.
Yeah.
But I wanted to make it more personal for her. But she said that he took her little blanket with him when he went over to Vietnam.
Mm.
And it was a little white blanket with a little pink bunny on it. So down in that foxhole where he's curled up, you can see him curled up and holding. It's the only color thing on
it. Dude, that's so intense.
Blanket with the pink bunny on it.
Yeah.
That's wild.
Experiences like that, man. I mean, how sacred is it?
Just to be a part of that, like putting that, like memorializing that on the person. Mm-hmm. Like, who knows what those coveralls and that means, but it's probably like the biggest influence, you know, the most influential thing in her life.
Yeah.
So much so she wanted to get it marked on her.
Yeah. And she turned out to be one of my middle son's teachers.
No, really? He should be getting A's. You should be good with him.
Right.
He didn't get in no trouble. I tell you that. He knew daddy was always watching.
Well, what we usually like to do to wrap up the show is have our guest, this is your camera here, it's just to send a message out for somebody who might be struggling or considering this way of life. What would you say to a person who's in that situation here today?
Surrender. You can't. God can. The only thing we got to figure out is how to get out of his way. I figured it out by walking to a meeting and having somebody that already walked the path for me. People that have problems with a higher power, like you were talking about, I always laugh at that in the meeting, and I'll say, well, go up and throw you an ounce of meth up on the Weiner Police Department's front counter, and you're going to see a whole lot of higher powers. They're going to come tackle you, and taser you, and cuff you, and put in your little concrete room. So you really don't have a problem with a God, because, I mean, you gave up everything for that dope or that liquor. So just surrender. Our way doesn't work. Even my way didn't work. My best decision making got me 18 years in crack houses and 6 times in prison. Never went to a meeting to stay sober, but it convinced me that very first meeting when I got woke up the next morning, I didn't have a hangover and I didn't have any warrants that it worked, at least for that. There's no rock bottom. Homeless, jobless, penniless, not even a driver's license. And today is very, very different. And that's why I like to come share it, because you look at all this and you say, ooh, Shane's doing good. No, you need to know God's doing great. Mm-hmm. And there ain't no car full of doorknobs in the Lamborghini when I leave a meeting and go by the hood where I did all my dirt. There ain't no chairs for a higher power. There's me, God, and 12 steps that keep me from turning left and going and getting high when nobody would know.
Mm-hmm.
And my integrity today is priceless to me. but it all come from just surrendering. I couldn't. I just could not stay sober. I couldn't. I still can't. It's not that I ever struggle to stay sober. I just don't have any desire to not be sober. There's nothing in my life that gets better by taking a drink or a drug. But you're not alone. If you've ever had to sleep in the woods with the same clothes on for weeks and not bathe, when you finally get arrested, they pull the boots off of you and they have to throw them away, and they can't stand the room and the smell in the holding tank, and you got zero hope and got charges pending. Been there.
Yeah.
There's somewhere else you can go, but you got to give up. Got to surrender.
Love that. Man,
that was great.
Yeah. Clip it.
My heart is gonna flutter. But I would like to point out, you know, we all, us three, we have the same amount of clean time.
Really?
So this was a message, guys.
I think we need to do this again. Guys. I think y'all need to come to the shop and let's do something.
Oh, yeah.
This is a message with three guys with 14, 15 years apiece, right?
Yep.
So I hope it made sense.
But you do it by giving back. I still give back. Like Atlanta Redemption Inc. I don't know if anybody knows about it, but Jessica, she's absolutely amazing. I've been there since the beginning. We do. We don't charge the client for the tattoo. They go through a screening process with AR. But it's for people that have been men that have been sex trafficked or held hostage as gangs or whatever. After they've gone through the process of recovery for a while, and we come in, we cover up those old tags or brands to mark their progress in recovery, because it is a sacred
step. Amazing, dude.
Yeah. You know, every Christmas Eve, we feed families and give Christmas gifts to kids that wouldn't have gifts. And this last year was our 11th year of doing it. We had like 56 bicycles at Stewart. He does a bicycle charity. He brought those and the church gave some stuff. And we all went and bought some stuff, and we cooked hams and prepared everything to serve people. That's the greatest joy in my life. And that's one of the things that changed about the nature of me as a human being is the do more to have more to share more, you know, and instead of just do more to have more.
Yeah.
Well, maybe the next time we get together, we'll film visiting Agape Inc.
I think that's a great idea.
And let's get carved up.
Thank you to the donors and supporters who make this show possible. And thank you for Kim running the ones and twos and Andrew doing the setup. This has been another episode of The Most High Show.
Yeah.